Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 45, entitled How to Master a Speech, we chat with best-selling author and master keynote speaker, Michael Port. On a side note, we meant to cover selling in this episode, but we simply ran out of time, so hopefully Michael can come back again at a later date and share his advice on that subject. But he really gives a thorough explanation and great advice on speech giving and the art of mastering the speech, so enjoy the show. All right, guys, we're live. I'm Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is none other than Michael Port. Michael, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
All right, cool. I'm pretty pumped for today's episode because I've always been a big fan of yours, Michael. I've watched a lot of your videos and stuff. You have a lot of great tips both on speaking and selling, so I kind of wanted to touch on those topics.
Sure. Happy to.
Cool. And also you have your book coming out, I believe, next week. What is it, the 6th?
Yeah, that's right. Steal the Show. It's my 6th book as well.
Wow.
And this is it. I'm done after this. I'm hanging up my computer, and I'm done. Every time I finish a book, I say, okay, listen, I tell all my friends, just punch me in the face if I say I'm going to write another one. So needless to say, I've had a lot of black eyes. Because I keep writing more, but this one is it. I mean, this is the book I always wanted to write. This is, you know, I was an actor. It was my first career before I went into business. And when I look back on my career, when I look back on the accomplishments that I've had, they are in large part due to my ability to perform and perform authentically. Because if you think about our life is made up of lots of high-stakes situations. And how we perform during those high-stakes situations, it often determines the quality of our life. And if we fall flat during those high-stakes situations, then we play a small game. But if we can shine during those high-stakes situations, when the spotlight is on you, well, then you get to play a big game. And that's what the book is about. It's not just about public speaking, although it is a tour de force on public speaking technique. It's also about performing stealing the show during life's everyday moments, job interviews, negotiations, sales pitches, you know, even meeting your future in-laws for the first time has some elements of performance. You know, you've got to control yourself. You got to calm yourself. You got to make sure that you stay on point and that you don't embarrass yourself. So, and you do it all authentically. So I'm really excited about this book coming out.
Yeah. You mentioned, I know I've heard you kind of, over the years, say that like you're acting in pretty much everything you do, right? And even Marlon Brando, I saw an interview with him with Larry King, said basically like Larry King was acting right now. He was acting. The guy behind the camera was acting. Like everyone in every moment is pretty much acting. So it's really important to just get that down and know how to act in the right situations, right?
Well, that's right. And, you know, sometimes that rubs people the wrong way when they hear it. This idea that people are acting all the time. I mean, Shakespeare said all the world's a stage because everything you do and everything you say tells the world something about you. And ultimately, you decide what you want the world to know, what you want them to think, how you want them to see you. And so, you know, you can put on a false persona and pretend you are something other than you are. And that's one way to go. I don't recommend it. Or you can play the right role in every situation based on your values, your personality, and, you know, how you want to connect with people. Because in Steal the Show, when I write about the audience, I'm not just talking about 1,000 people in theater. I'm talking about one person sitting across the desk from you. Because performing at the end of the day is about connecting. And you don't need to be an entertainer to be a performer. You don't need to be a comedian to be a performer. You don't even need to be big and charismatic to be a performer. Sometimes big, charismatic people have trouble because they try to take over situations which is not the role they should be playing in that particular situation. Or the big personality salesperson often bowls over a potential buyer because they can't adjust their way of being. So one of the things that I focus on in Steal the Show is being able to adopt different styles of behavior authentically. And that's really, really key, because if I want to be invited to hang out with the guys down at the dock, I need to make them feel comfortable. And if I'm invited to hang out with the librarians, I need to make them feel comfortable. But each one of those groups has a different energy, is a different style, is different ways of being. And the question is, can I adapt to those different styles of behavior? And if the answer is yes, well, then I get to be parts of lots of different environments. I have lots of different opportunities. More doors are open, more exposure. But if you can only behave one way, well, then you only get to be in one environment.
Yeah, it makes total sense, man.
Yeah.
What has acting given you as far as like actionable ways or different implementations in your personal and, I guess, business life too? Because, you know, you've had success acting, but you also took it even further now with your speaking and coaching, et cetera.
Sure. So anytime you create a speech or go in for a job interview or a sales meeting, you want to make sure that you have a big idea that is relevant to those people. And that's what you base all of your work on. And that big idea leads to a promise, because you make a promise anytime you give a speech, anytime you go in for a job interview, anytime you are in a sales pitch, anytime you're in a negotiation, anytime you, you know, meet a potential girlfriend or boyfriend, you are making a promise to them to serve them in some way. And if you also know, if you also can demonstrate that you know how the world looks to them, then they will connect with you. Because if they don't think you know how the world looks to them, they see you as distant from them. They see you as disconnected from them. And they need to know that the messenger is the right messenger for them. Because you could bring them a message that's important to them, but if they don't connect with the messenger, they're not going to listen to the message. So if you have a big idea, you can make a promise that you can demonstrate that the world, you know how the world looks to them, and you can demonstrate the consequences of not adopting, you know, this new big idea and going after this promise, and you can demonstrate the rewards of adopting this big idea and going after this promise. Well, then the doors will open. And that those are specific techniques that one uses when they develop a character as an actor. When you develop a character, what you're doing is you're trying to identify what that character wants to achieve. And then you try to achieve that by every means necessary. Now, in a play or a movie or a TV show, the screenwriter may write your character in such a way that you will do anything illegal, immoral, or unethical to get that thing. But in our real lives, we're making sure that the tactics we choose are legal, moral, and ethical, of course. But the same principles apply in that, you know, if there's something that you want, you've got to decide how you're going to go get it. And if you don't go after it with high stakes, if you're ambivalent about it, or you don't want to show anyone how much you really care, you know, you're probably not going to be too compelling, because the performer is compelling when they commit fully. And a performer that doesn't commit fully, you know, doesn't get a lot of attention. And so our reputation is in large part based on our ability to make commitments and fulfill them. Look, if we make a lot of commitments but don't fulfill them, well, nobody wants to play with us again. And if we won't make commitments in the first place, you know, someone says, hey, you want to do this thing? Like, well, I'm not sure. Maybe I'll get to it. You know, then nobody wants to play with us at all. They don't even ask us, you know, to come down to the park. So your reputation is in large part based on your ability to make commitments and fulfill them. And the stronger you go after the fulfillment of those commitments, the more you'll accomplish. Now, additionally, the performer is loath to go after approval. This is a very dangerous intention. And if you, in your own life, spend your time focused on approval, you tend to water yourself down. You tend to pander. You tend to play the roles that you think other people want you to play. Or you let other people cast you in roles that you do not want to play. And you end up playing supporting roles, you know, in the background, and often aren't particularly satisfied with them. That's not the way that we want to live our life, I don't think. No, I don't think so. So, you know, the question is, are you willing to make choices, make big choices, make them early, make them often, and decide the roles that you want to play? And so, you know, you're much more compelling when you make those kind of choices. People are attractive. The kind of people who make choices are attractive. You know, even if you don't love every choice that they make, you still are generally impressed with them. You go, you know what? You know, they know what they want. They're going after it, and they're going to do what they can to get it.
Yeah, and unapologetic about it. In acting, how do you, like, fully embrace a role? How do you step into that? Because I actually took an acting class before. I mean, not really much of an actor. I just took it, you know, for a semester or whatever. And
sure.
I really loved it. It did a lot for me personally, you know, confidence-wise, yeah. Et cetera. It was just really – it was amazing. But
yeah,
one of the tough things I kind of noticed as just, like, a first-time actor – mm-hmm. was really like trying to step in and embrace like different roles that I wasn't necessarily comfortable doing. So how would you kind of do that?
That's exactly right. And that's why the model of acting is such a useful tool for all aspects of our life, because, you know, you said I had to play a role that I wasn't really comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So how do you embrace that? And the same thing happens in our regular life, isn't it? You know, if we get a promotion, well, all of a sudden we're now playing a different role. And, you know, we've got to embrace that role, even if it requires us to do things that, you know, we've never done before or, you know, don't feel comfortable doing initially. So there's a couple different things that you can do. Number one, you can care more about the results than the approval. As I mentioned, this is really key, because if you care more about the results, then you're not focused on whether or not you're going to get rejected and whether or not people are going to like you and all those downward drivers. This is really important. We've got to ask ourselves, what's more important, results or approval? And if results are more important than approval, then you can use the technique of acting as if. This is a very important acting technique. When you embrace a different way of being, a different style of behavior, you embrace the characters that you're playing as an actor. The same thing is true when you embrace the different roles that you play in regular life. You act as if you are comfortable in that role. You act as if you are capable of doing the things that are required of you or asked of you. And acting as if eventually will turn into acting as is. And it's a little bit different than fake it till you make it, although Amy Cuddy, who is a researcher at Harvard, has done some really interesting studies on faking it till you make it from a body language, physical point of view. She actually put people into certain poses, like, say, a superhero pose, the way Superman stands with his fists on his hips and his elbows out to the side and with his legs shoulder width apart. And they stand up straight. And after 2 minutes of that, it increases your testosterone and decreases your cortisol. So it actually changes the way you feel about yourself. And that's quite extraordinary. And the same thing is true mentally. You can do the same thing mentally. If you act as if, it will start to become true for you. And that's what the performer does. But they're always drawing on their own sensibilities, their own emotional life, their own history. So, for example, when Tom Hanks is playing a role, you know, he knows that he's not actually a soldier in World War II. He knows that he's on a film set and there's cameras there and he's wearing a costume and he has to memorize the lines that that character says. But what you see him going through emotionally is real. It's true for him. He's not pretending to cry. He's actually crying because he's allowing himself to feel what that character would feel in that situation. He's acting as if he's actually in that situation. And the same thing is true for us. The reason that Tom Hanks can do it is because he's willing to allow people to see him messy, vulnerable, uncomfortable. But are we willing to do that? I don't know. That's the big question. And what we do is we end up wrapping ourselves up in these false layers of persona. You know, we act cool. We put on our shades and our leather jacket. And we wrap ourselves up in this armor. We protect ourselves. And then we're critical, you know, of others. We're a little sarcastic. You know, we tend to say things like, I don't understand why anybody listens to their podcast, because, I mean, it's not like they're doing anything different or new. You know, I asked I was on Lewis Howes' podcast yesterday, and we were talking about criticism, because anytime you do anything in the world in a big way, you get criticized. I mean, look at the way people criticize actors. Look at the way they criticize politicians. Look at, I mean, maybe those are deserved. But outside of that, look at the way writers are criticized. Anytime you do anything out in the world in a big way, you're going to get some criticism. And one of the reasons that people don't, you know, make these big, you know, attempts to make a difference in the world is because they don't want that criticism. And we criticize ourselves and we let other people criticize us. But when we criticize ourselves, you know, the voices of judgment in our head that tell us we're not enough, you don't know enough, you'll never be enough. Then the voices outside, those voices from people who like to push other people down to lift themselves up, well, those voices are even louder. But if we can silence the voices in our own head, and that's chapter two in Steal the Show, well, then those voices out in the cheap seats, we don't hear them as much. We just don't care as much, frankly, because we're focused on the result, what we're trying to achieve. And when Lewis and I were talking yesterday, I was making this point. I said, you can be a performer or you can be a critic, but I don't think you can be both. Now, there's a place for critics in the art world. I understand that, professionals. I've never read their criticism. It's not something that's interest me. I'd rather create. But if you look at Facebook, if you look at Twitter, you know, especially Facebook, Facebook seems to be rampant with this. It's a place where in your feed, you generally see a significant amount of criticism. You know, your friends, your colleagues are criticizing something. I mean, I'm part of this group of professional speakers, and it's a great group, and I got lots of friends in there. But a lot of the posts end up making fun of other speakers, and they won't use their names necessarily, but they'll make comments while they're sitting watching another speaker who's, you know, just went after them or before them, and they'll put down, you know, what that particular speaker is doing. And I just don't understand that at all. Yeah, sure, maybe you don't resonate with it. You know, maybe it doesn't work as well as you think what you do, as well as what you do, you think works, something like that. You understand? It's like this. Why do we need to do that? You know, someone could listen to this podcast, be like, oh, I thought Michael's I've heard him called a public speaking phenom, but he just twisted up his words. He must be bullshit. That's not, you know, because it's nice, you know, if we have an excuse to think that other people don't have what we don't have, even though it seems like they're, you know, it's like this. So I think you got to decide which one you want to be, a performer or a critic. So back to the Lewis thing, I asked him, I said, let me ask you a question, Lewis. Have you ever written on Amazon or iTunes? Have you ever written a negative review of anything that you've ever heard? He said, no, come to think of it, I never have. I said, neither have I. I said, why is that? He says, I guess we're just making things. We're not reviewing things. I said, exactly. And listen, I've written reviews, but I write them when I have something positive to say. because I'm not in the business of tearing other people's work down. Anybody can do that. I'm in the business of trying to create something for the people that I serve. That's it. So most people whose work you don't resonate with, it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with it or it's bad. It's just you don't resonate with it. But I'm very, you know, I talk about this often because I think it's so important for us to move away from being a critic and being judgmental, because I think it's very hard to take risks yourself, to be an artist yourself, to be a creator yourself, when you are focused on putting others down, because you'll be too nervous to try to do it yourself because you know what's going to come at you and you'll feel like you deserve it. Subconsciously, you'll feel like you deserve it because you've been doing it to other people all this time.
Yeah, no, that's a great, great point, man. Come to think of it, I can't really recall writing a review either at some point. Maybe I have, but I know I write reviews for like friends or whatever if they want me to check out their book or something like that, but I never really wrote a negative review either, so I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not putting people down who write negative reviews. I mean, certainly, as I said, there's a place for it, but there's a difference between critiquing something and just writing a negative review. Mm-hmm. You know, if I bought a product and the product broke immediately, and I tried to send the product back, I said, can you give me one that works? And they wouldn't. I might write a review saying, listen, here's what happened. The product came, it broke. I asked them if they would send me a new one. They wouldn't. I'm just writing the facts. Okay. But because that's not subjective, that's objective. And then just people can know if that company, you know, honors their promises or not. I might do that. I don't typically, but I might do that. But I'm not going to read a book and then go and bash the author. I'm just not going to do it. So the way I look at art is it's an individual experience. Public speaking is art. Writing is art. Podcasting is art. It's all like a form of art. And you resonate with some, you resonate with less with others. And I also don't expect anybody to be perfect. So I read a lot of books about investing. And there are some books that are hard for me to understand in parts because they're very academic. And there's a lot of math, and math is not exactly my strong suit. Although I do remember from, I remember the quadratic equation, which is minus B plus or minus the square root of B squared minus 4AC over 2A. That's the one. I don't know what you do with it. I wouldn't know how to plug the numbers into it. I'd have to use a calculator to actually do the calculation, but I do remember it. But I don't understand a lot of the mathematics associated with, or introduced in some of these books. But I'm not going to rail against the author because I can't understand his math. You know, I might read a book, and if I get four things out of that book that I can do something with, to me, that's a successful book.
Yeah.
So in any event, I may have gone on too long about this, but it is a soapbox of mine because I think that you don't feel good about yourself when you're putting other things down.
All right, guys, I think it's the perfect time to take a quick break from the episode to remind you to subscribe to our show. By subscribing, you get every single episode completely free. That's right, get all of our best interviews with the best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and entrepreneurial worlds absolutely free. Don't miss out on any one of our captivating and exciting episodes. Subscribe now and get all of the Elite Man podcast anytime and anywhere. And yes, if you get a chance, leave us a glowing review about how much you love the show and how awesome we are. Okay, guys, back to the episode now. Moving on, can you kind of get into the speaking aspect of things? I know I really wanted to touch on this point. You're obviously one of the best speakers in the world. You know, you get so many fans and so many awesome video clips and just great speeches that you've made over the years. Just a few different like basic tips for speaking, how to improve like today.
Sure. Well, let's start with some basic ones. One of the things that you would be well served to avoid is pacing. Pacing is very common, and you'll often see that in speakers. And one of the reasons that it happens is because you have energy and you've got some extra nervous energy and you're not sure what to do with it. And if you haven't rehearsed and blocked out the movement of the presentation, then you might not know where to go, so you kind of wander and pace. So this happens a lot. And blocking is the organization of the movement of a piece. And it won't always be exactly the same when you're giving speeches like it would if you were doing a play, because the space will change when you're giving speeches. Sometimes you'll be on a big stage. Sometimes you'll be in a conference room and you'll have different physical constraints. But if you have a basic blocking that will allow you to use the space in a way that is more powerful visually to the audience and also allows you to be more powerful in your body because you're connected to the movement of the piece, you're much more powerful. And movement is in large part about transitions. And often when somebody speaks, they move all the way through something without many transitions. And when you're watching a speech, which is different than a conversation has lots of transitions because there are two people in the conversations and they transition as a result of talking with each other. You know, you'll transition by asking a question that's different than the question you asked previously. But on stage, when you're on your own, you've got to create those transitions, and the audience needs to help. The audience needs to be able to follow those transitions, and your physical movement helps you significantly. Rehearsal is a very important part of any presentation, and it's not something that most people do, really, because, you know, they never learned how to. And when I have a master's in acting from NYU, so I spent years studying rehearsal. That's what we did. You rehearse often more than you actually perform when you're younger. So I wouldn't expect anybody to know how to rehearse. And then what happens, of course, is you do a little bit of rehearsal and then you get on stage and you feel stiff because you're trying to recall what you did in rehearsal rather than being in the moment during the presentation. And so then you think rehearsal makes you stiff. And that's usually the feedback that I get. I go, no, I don't want to rehearse. I just want to be really natural, because if I rehearse, I'm going to be stiff. But I ask, well, why do you think you're going to be stiff, you know, if you rehearse? And they said, well, because I've tried it. And I said, well, how much rehearsal? Well, I could do like an hour or two. But an hour or two of rehearsal is just going to get you thinking about what you might want to do in that presentation, but it's not going to be in your body. It's not going to be rote for you. Because what you want to do is get to the point where you've done so much rehearsal that the material is so ingrained, the physical movement is so ingrained in your body that before you go give the speech, you actually imagine, you act as if you're throwing it all away and you have no idea what you're going to do. But allow what you have rehearsed to come to you in the moment when you're actually giving the presentation. So it feels to the audience like it's the first time that it's ever occurred. And so what you're doing is you're walking this beautiful line right in the middle of preparedness and improvisation. And that's what produces spontaneity. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're looking for. And that's what excites an audience. You want them on the edge of their seats, not knowing what's going to happen next. And that leads into contrast. Contrast is a very important part of any type of presentation. So if you watch a film and the whole thing feels like it's one note, nothing really happens, or the character doesn't really change, then it gets boring. Or an even simpler example would be listening to a violinist play the most beautiful note in the world for 3 hours. After a while, you'd say, you know what, I'm not so sure I want to listen to this note anymore. But what's beautiful about the music is that there are hundreds, thousands, even millions of notes. And Idina Menzel, who is arguably one of the most accomplished musical theater singers in history, she sings the lead character in Frozen, sings that theme song from Frozen. And she said that in a musical, she has to hit about 3.5 million notes. Wow. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that. That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the reason that she's so compelling to listen to is because she's hitting all these different notes, and she just keeps you on the edge of her seat with all this contrast. So in a speech, we're looking for content contrast, emotional contrast, and delivery contrast. Now, content contrast is the information that we're delivering and the structure of it. So that we use different frameworks throughout and different types of content. So sometimes we'll use a story to illustrate a point. We'll use an analogy. And of course, people are able to connect with analogies and stories in a way that's different than if they were just hearing bullet points. But then we might switch over to a chronological, step-by-step, very linear process, which helps people consume the how-to type information. And then we're moving into another type of framework, maybe a compare and contrast framework or a problem solution framework or a modular framework. And inside, we're integrating stories and analogies and lots of different content-based experiences for the audience. And in Steal the Show, I outline all of these frameworks because it's very important that your information is well organized. You're perceived as an expert when you give a speech when your information is well organized. So you may be an expert, but if you don't introduce it in a way that's well organized during a speech, then they may not perceive you to be the expert that you are. So those frameworks are very important. That's content contrast. There's difference there. Then there's also emotional contrast. Very important. It's not one note. If you go out and give a speech and the whole note is high energy, you know, like, I need more energy in this room. Let's go. You know, that kind of thing. After a while, people are like, dude, I can't take this anymore. It's too intense. And on the flip side, if it's really low energy for 60 minutes. I mean, you can't even, that was probably 5 seconds. Yeah. It's almost hard, too hard to take. So that's on the extreme, but we want to move back and forth. We want intensity and we want softness. We want laughter, humor, and we want sadness. We want lightness and we want seriousness. We want intellectual stimulation and we want a little bit of fluff to relax our brain in there too. So when you're crafting your presentation, you're trying to put as much emotional contrast in there as possible. So the audience is on the edge of their seat. And that's when, you know, if you think about your favorite movie or your favorite TV show, there's lots of emotional contrast. It's a roller coaster ride of emotion and it's very exciting. And then finally, you have delivery contrast, the ways that you deliver the content and this emotional contrast. So you might use your words, you might use video, you might use still images on a screen. Although I generally, when people come and do our master classes and our graduate programs, they'll often come in with slide decks with, you know, dozens or even hundreds of slides. And most of them are left on the floor of the theater by the time their speeches have reworked. I also do these A-lister master classes with a very, very high level professional speakers, and they'll come together as a small group because they often like to be in a small group together rather than in the big events. And one of the things that they say at the end every single time is, oh my God, I had no idea that I could do this without slides. And yet, and one of my metrics is, if you can't give your speech without the slides, then you might not be ready to give the speech.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Now, there are some speeches that are well served by visuals, and the visuals help tell an incredible story. But you of course, need to rehearse a lot so that those are seamlessly integrated into everything that you say. You know, if you're looking at your slides to know what's coming next, then you probably want some more rehearsal. So delivery contrast, you might be in the audience. You might be on the stage. You might sit on the edge of the stage. You might stand on a chair. You might have people come up on stage and role play. You might do audience interaction techniques. And Steal the Show, I do a massive chapter on audience interaction because it's such an important component. But all in audience interaction must be proportionate to the amount of trust that you've earned. That's critical. Audience interaction must be proportionate to the amount of trust that you've earned. And if we come out and ask too much of an audience at the beginning, we may scare them. And we don't want to scare our audiences. So, for example, let's say I came out at the beginning of a speech and I said, okay, listen, everybody, and they don't know me. Assuming they don't really, they go, maybe they know who I am, but they don't know me. They've really never had any interaction, so they don't trust me yet. I say, all right, listen, and there's 1,000 people there. Raise your hand if you've ever been in debt. Really? I'm not so sure everybody's going to want to raise their hand. You know, that's one of those things that might be private. Maybe when I've created an enormous amount of trust and they feel like they're in a safe environment and they are just like the other people in the room, maybe. Or it's like me, okay, raise your hand if you're an alcoholic or an addict or like, you know, you've got pot in your pocket. You know, you just, it just wouldn't do that. But you often see speakers asking for more than they have earned. And, you know, when you see somebody doing something that, you know, like that, we can't, don't fault them for it. They are trying to do the best job that they know how to do. They just haven't yet learned that they need to earn more trust yet. That's all. And they really are trying to serve the audience in the best way that they know how. So if you're a speaker and you read Steal the Show, or you know, you pick up any of the tip sheets, or I do a podcast called Steal the Show. I released it with the book. Now, actually, this morning it was number one in New and Notable Business, number one in New and Notable Education, number one in New and Notable Society and Culture. That's a hat trick right there. So, and I detail, I go very, very technical. The podcast is just me teaching more like an audio course. Into these particular types of topics. And if you listen, there's a once or twice a week I do showstoppers, and they're the things that you shouldn't do on stage. And if you hear me telling you, you know, you shouldn't do this, and you realize, my God, I've been doing that. He's right. I probably shouldn't do that. Don't be upset with yourself. I still make mistakes. I make mistakes all the time. I've been learning these techniques over the last 20 years plus. And so experience is often, you know, the best teacher in the world, because when I look back on some of my performances from 10 years ago, I go, oh my God, really? I cannot, really? I did that? Really? And that's just the evolution of it. One of the things that I found very interesting that, I'm blanking on his name right now. Generally, when you want to bring up a story, don't forget the name of the person who the story is about. Ira Glass. Thank you very much. And then what I did there is just an example of, you know, an audience will not fault you if you forget something or make a mistake, as long as you don't fault yourself for it. If you get nervous and really, you know, freeze up about it and feel like you have to get that name and won't go on until you get that name, then the audience gets uncomfortable. But if you forget a name, you know what? It'll come back to me in a minute. They're okay with that, just like they anybody would if they were having a normal conversation with you. The audience doesn't fault you if you are trying to do your best to serve them. So Ira Glass, who is an NPR host, very famous, he said that when you're first starting out as an artist, and if you give speeches, think of yourself as an artist, you often get frustrated because your taste is much more developed than your skill set. So you don't feel like you can produce something as good as you think it should be. And you get discouraged. And then you don't continue on. And the artist who is experienced will tell you, that's exactly right. Eventually, you get to the point where you can make something that you feel is worthy of your taste. And that's exciting. And that just takes some work over time. Something like speaking is a skill set that you develop over time. It's not something that you can read three easy steps. You read an article and you can master speaking. It's just like martial arts. You're not going to master martial arts in a week or two. It's going to take some real time. I mean, we live in a hacking culture now. You know, we want to biohack. We want to life hack. And I love it. Like, I'm a fast learner. I always want to know just what I want to know in order – what do I need to know in order to do the thing competently? And then if I'm interested, then I will pursue mastery and go deeper into the micro aspects of that particular discipline. So I love that. However, if you really do pursue mastery, that is something that takes time. And so I know in this life hacking culture, you know, we get focused on doing things really quite quickly. But ultimately, we know that we need time and hours of training to get really, really, really good at something and win using those techniques rather than sort of cheating ourselves into, into an advanced position. So over time, you get better and you will be proud of the work you do. Because you'll be putting effort into it.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of great points you make there, Michael. I want to touch on a few of those, but let's just start with first, how long would you rehearse in terms of, say, hours for something like an hour speech or a half-hour speech? Like how long, I know probably you want to say something along the lines of like until you get it down, but like...
No, yeah, yeah. like, okay, 42.4 hours. No, it depends on a couple different things. It depends on the stakes. You know, how important is this is one of the questions that you ask yourself. And if the stakes are incredibly high, you're going to want to give yourself more and more rehearsal. So we tend to prioritize, or we should prioritize, and put the most effort into the things that produce the most results. So that's one question we ask. So, for example, my Think Big Revolution speech, and you can see a 16-minute excerpt of that at michaelport.com. It is a show. It's a keynote, but it feels more like a one-man show. It's quite fun. I have scenes where I talk to voices coming out of speakers. I have phone conversations that you can listen in on. There's a lot of very unusual experiences in there. So it feels more like a show rather than me just telling people, you know, here's what you should do if you want to play a big game. I show them and it's fun. So the phone conversation is me talking to two different people, and they're railing on me because I didn't deliver on my promise. And so what I'm doing is I'm demonstrating what happens if you don't deliver on your promises, rather than just saying, okay, everybody, listen, you really should deliver on your promises, which, you know, doesn't have as much weight and is not as much fun, because now people love entertainment. They want an experience when they watch a speech. And again, you don't have to be a comedian, but they want to have an experience. So with that said, that from start to finish, that was about 500 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. But that includes all the content creation, because that particular speech is I've written as a script. So it's fully memorized. But when you watch it, you don't recognize that it's memorized. It just is seamless. And that's the key. It works because it's that well rehearsed. But you do not need to do 500 hours. If you're not a professional speaker, then, you know, the same is not expected of you. For those who are professionals, I ask my professional students to work a lot harder on their rehearsal, because a lot of them are subject matter experts. They write books and then they give speeches on those books and they think, oh, well, I'll put my notes together and I know the material really, really well, so I'll be able to go out and charm them. But if they're, you know, if they're getting paid a lot of money, I think they probably should put some more work into the preparation for those particular performances if they want it to be as good as the book. It takes a year and a half to write a book for most people, from the conception to the end. You write a book proposal, you sell it to the publisher, then you write the book. Maybe that's 6 or 8 months, different time periods for different authors. And then it's another six months before it comes out. So it's a long period. Then you have a whole marketing period. But yet we will often do a speech and we'll put it together, the night or two before we actually give it. I'm not sure what the difference is between the two. One has 70,000 words written. The other has, maybe 20,000 words spoken. So that's, there's that. So I'll give you a number. So if you're doing a 60-minute speech, think about giving yourself 40 hours of rehearsal.
Yep.
It's not actually that much if you think about it.
Yeah.
It's 1 hour a day for 40 days.
Yeah, a week's worth for rehearsal.
Yeah. Or just, block out the whole week and rehearse 6 hours a day or 8 hours a day for 5 days.
Is it as simple as just kind of standing in front of a mirror and practicing yourself?
Ah, yes, please. No. Don't stand in front of the mirror. Think about it. It's kind of strange. Think about looking at yourself in the mirror, trying to respond to yourself as if you were an audience member, but yourself is saying exactly what you're saying. At the same time, you're saying it with the same expression that you're using. It's weird. It doesn't really work. You won't find a professional actor who does that. I mean, maybe to admire their jawline, that's actors might do that. But no, you don't want to do that. You want to start. There's a step-by-step process in the book about this. And you start usually with what's called a table read. This is what the actor does. So before you get up on your feet and start trying to perform it, you read through it at the table. And even if you haven't written out a script, you've written a bullet, you've written an outline with bullet points, key points, notes on the stories you're going to tell. You do the whole thing sitting down, and you do this probably about 10 times, and you'll start to find what's different between the spoken word and the written word. And that'll start to get you more comfortable with the material. And that's the first step. And then you start to do what's called content mapping. And content mapping is a process for finding the beats. And the beats are the pauses, the transitions. And in those pauses and transitions, there's usually a lot of weight. The audience consumes what you just said in those beats and transitions. You're finding the operative words. The operative words are the most important words in a particular sentence or phrase. And they change the meaning of a phrase if you use a different operative word. So if I say, let's see, what's a good one? Say, I love Jan. If I say, I love Jan, I don't know who Jan is. My fiance's name is Amy. So let's say I love Jan is very different than saying, I love Jan.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a lot of weight when you say, I love Jan. Well, you mean as opposed to someone else? You know, that it changes the meaning of the phrase. So the operative words are very important. And one of the things that we teach is we work on speech and voice, because you also want lots of contrast in your pitch, your tone, your pacing, your timing. That makes a big difference, because you don't need to slow down necessarily. Advice is often given to people to slow down when they speak quickly. Speaking quickly is fine as long as you pause. If you speak quickly but never pause, the audience never has an opportunity to consume what you offered them. But if you pause, it gives them time to consume. And when you have the stage, you can pause for as long as you want because you're in control of that space. It's different than when you're on a podcast. If I pause for a long time, you go, oh, he's done. Now I should go. So, you know, when you're doing podcasting, it's a little bit different. You have to – usually your pause is a little bit shorter, and also on the air, sometimes air is considered dead air. So it's a little bit of each medium is a little bit different, and we need to adjust according to the medium that we're in. So you do this content mapping, and then once you've done the table reading, the content mapping, then you put it up on its feet, and then you start to work on the blocking, the movement. And this is something that you notate in your script, where you're moving, when, why you're moving. And you start to work through the whole presentation on that. And at the same time, you're also improving the content because you realize what works and what needs improvement. Now, once you've done all of that, then you get to the point where you can put the book down, so to speak. It's called being off book. You put your script down, you put your notes down, and you start working from memory. And you work for a period of time from memory. Then once you've worked from memory and you feel that you're pretty good, pretty close, you start to bring in invited guests. And when you bring in these invited guests, you do the performance for them as if you were doing it for a real audience. And then you get feedback, you solicit feedback. And one of the things that one of the bonuses that I give away with the book, if people buy it at steeltheshow.com, is a template for getting feedback, because you want to get the right feedback. Because unless you have a high-level professional coach with you, people might not be able to tell you what to do to improve. Well, actually, they will try to tell you what to do to improve, but they may not be on the money. Most of us feel like we know what we like and we know what we don't like. We don't always know why something works or why it doesn't, but a professional will often know why something works and why it doesn't. And that's important. That's very different. So you don't want non-professionals to start directing your presentations if they don't really have the experience or knowledge. So we're very careful and very specific about how we elicit feedback and the kind of feedback that we're looking for. Then you take that feedback and you go rehearse. And then you bring in another invited audience and you do the same thing, and you do this for some time until you're ready to perform. So the Think Big Revolution is a good example. The first time I did that, the first time I was scheduled to do that speech was in Australia for 3,500 people. And I had never done it before. I'd been working on it specifically for this particular event, and then I would, you know, bring it out to other events after that. But I was not going to do it for a crowd that size for the first time, as the first time I'd ever done it for a crowd. Mm-hmm. Because speeches change, jokes change, stories change, timing changes when there are people there. And it's important to have some kind of audience. So what I did is I actually put on a show in New York, a keynote in New York for 200 people, and I had them pay. Fortunately, because I have, readers, they usually want to come to these kind of things. And I said, listen, I'm going to do a day masterclass on public speaking. And in the morning, I'm going to open with this brand new keynote. You're going to get to see the first time I've ever done it. And so they knew it was a first time. It was what I would call a dress rehearsal. And this way I could do it for a crowd before I went and did it for, you know, a large crowd. And it made such a difference, and it worked really well. You know, it went off without a hitch. And then I was able to do it, you know, really well 3 weeks later when I went to Australia for that other group. But the rehearsal was key. And then, of course, the preview performance made a big difference.
Do you have to have that energy every time you're on, you're given a performance like a speech? And does that come naturally to you, or can anyone kind of pick up on that and just like have incredible energy like you have when you're on stage? And sort of mimic that.
Yes, energy is very important on stage. As we discussed before, if you're incredibly low energy and what I would call back on your heels, and maybe literally, but figuratively, your energy is not moving toward the audience. Everything you do needs to move toward them, drives forward. Now, that doesn't mean you have to have Tony Robbins energy. I couldn't maintain a Tony Robbins energy. That guy is, you know, he's a freak of nature. He really is. So that everyone should have their own style, and that's critical. So, you know, we've trained thousands of performers at this point, and I would challenge anyone to watch our performers or to figure out which ones are ours. Because, I mean, you know, if you had 100 great performances, you're not going to be able to tell which ones are ours and which ones are not, because we don't teach anyone to be like us or anybody else. I would never teach someone to speak in my style. My style is my style. Each one of us is an individual, and we want to leverage our own individual talents, our own individual strengths, our personalities, and amplify the compelling parts of our personalities and create a stage character, a stage presence that works well for us. And that's why I want the technique to be translucent. No, not translucent, transparent. I want it to be, you can't see any technique. It's seamless. It's completely invisible. But what happens is an extraordinary performance by the speaker and a deep connection to the audience. That's what we're going for. And when we work, and when our coaches work with people, we're looking for the individual and how to amplify that. Now, with that said, energy is still very important. We have to bring energy, and we want speakers to bring that kind of energy. And the energy is often a demonstration of how hard they care about trying to reach us. So your personality, you have got a mellow energy. You're kind of mellow. You're like, hey, what's up, man? How you doing? Right? And that's, you're from New England.
Yeah.
Boston?
Yep.
Yeah, so my mom's family is all from Boston. So I love the Boston accent. My grandmother, every time she leaves a message for me, she says, sweetheart, love you, face, bubbler. I'm so lonesome for you. Every single time. It's just, you know, every time. It's the same exact message. She once came to New York City. First time she came to New York City in the 70s, she got in a taxi cab at LaGuardia Airport, and my parents lived on Park Avenue. So she sit not in the, at the time it was in the not fancy part of Park Avenue. Just let me make that really clear. It was in the 90s. The 90s and the 70s was not exactly a fancy part of Park Avenue. So she got in the cab and she said, I want to go to 1185 Park Avenue. And the cab driver said, where? What? And she said, Park Avenue. He said, I don't know where that is, ma'am. She said, Park Avenue, P-A-R-K. And he said, oh, Park Avenue, why didn't you say so? She said, I did. So in any event, she loves that story. She's 102, turning 103 in December.
Wow.
She still tells that story as if it was yesterday. Yeah. So in any event, yeah, you've got a mellow energy. And what we would do is we would look at how to exploit that, but make sure so that people are really like relaxed with you and calm and you're easy and naturalistic, and it makes people feel comfortable. We would just have to make sure that it doesn't fall into a pattern that becomes too slow for them or too low energy for them that would lull them into a passive state. So it's finding the higher energy places to create some contrast, but still allow you to be very, very much in line with your natural patterns and your natural sensibilities.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense, man.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, I'm obviously getting a lot out of this, even just personally, you know, because I do speeches from time to time. And thinking of my audience who listen to the show, just it feels like a lot of them are probably introverted, kind of quiet guys similar to me.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's great to know that you can really do good and kind of that you teach them how to work on what they have naturally.
That's right. And there's, I think, a difference. You know, we use the term introvert a lot. You might be surprised to know that I would consider myself relatively introverted. Mm-hmm. Even though when I perform, I can bring a very big energy to that space. And often the bigger the space, you know, the more energy you need. But I don't love being in crowds. I don't love being at big dinner parties. I don't love going to concerts. I find all the people overwhelming. Like the first thing I do, I was at an MMA fight last year, and I was on the floor, and it was in a huge, huge arena. And my seats were on the floor. It was great. But the first thing I do when I walk in there is I figure out where all the exits are.
Yeah.
Like, how am I going to get out of here if this doesn't go well? That's the first thing I want to know. And of course, there was a fight in the first set of seats behind us between two women. Funny enough, and it took about 5 minutes before the security got there. So then I really made sure I had an exit plan. But in any event, so there's a difference, I think, between introvert and extrovert, certainly. But I think sometimes we conflate being a little bit shy or mellow with being an introvert. And they may not necessarily be the same thing. Mm-hmm. So there are some people who are quite quiet but love to be around crowds. They really like it. So they may be quite extroverted in the way that they interact with people. They like the crowds. They like the energy. They just don't talk that much. But yet we think we say, oh, well, they're introverted because they don't talk that much. So I don't want us to label ourselves in any way and make an assumption that, well, I'm this way, so I can't do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, what do we care more about? Do we care more about doing the work and reaching the people we're meant to serve and accomplishing our goals, or staying so true to the idea that we have about ourselves so that we're rigidly fixed in this one way of being? And I would take the former.
Yeah. And that all kind of comes back to kind of what we talked about earlier in the acting and really embracing that role and not really and just kind of diving into it and actually becoming that person.
That's right. Exactly right.
Michael, we've, you know, talked about a lot of great things today, man. Got some awesome tips out of you. Is there any sort of send-off message or final takeaway you'd like to leave our audience?
Yeah, I would say, you know, just keep thinking big about who you are and what you offer the world. And know that, you know, you've got a performer in you. And if you want to bring that out, you know, slowly but surely, you absolutely can. There's no doubt in my mind. You might not, you know, turn into a Winston Churchill, you know, might not be a Martin Luther King, the, you know, greatest speakers of all time, but you will become better than you are today. And that's really all that we can ask of ourselves. Just keep getting a little bit better every day.
Awesome, man. And a place for our audience to check you out and find out more about you.
Yeah. So Steal the Show is a great place to go right now, especially if you want to pick up a copy of the book, because we give away lots of bonuses and add-ons and supplementary materials. So go to stealtheshow.com and listen to the podcast, Steal the Show. Right now I'm dropping an episode every weekday. So five episodes a week. You've got episodes that are 5 minutes and 25, 30 minutes. So there's a lot there for you. And anytime you need me, just shoot me an email at questions@michaelport.com. That's questions@michaelport.com.
All right, Michael, definitely appreciate the interview again, man. Awesome, awesome tips. And I know our audience is going to love this one. So thanks again for coming on, man.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing, you get every single episode completely free. That's right, get all of our best interviews with the best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and entrepreneurial worlds absolutely free. Don't miss out on any one of our captivating and exciting shows. Subscribe now and get the Elite Man podcast anytime and anywhere. And yes, if you get a chance, leave us a glowing review about how much you love the show and how awesome we are. All right, guys, that's it. Until next time, take care.